So I've been asked to speak about pulse diagnosis. In a sense, it's a unique opportunity because I really only teach pulse diagnosis to my close students now, the people who work with me in the two-year classes that I give. And I don't travel and teach pulse much because there are people giving their whole lives to teaching pulse, like Leon Hammer and his students. What can we do in a weekend on pulse diagnosis? It's really, you know, Chinese medicine is a science of holding duality. And the duality here is that on the one hand, asking to take a weekend course on pulse would be like getting a weekend course on playing classical violin, right? Or a weekend class on Chinese medicine. So on the other hand, most of the people in this room are practitioners, right? Most are practitioners. And the simple fact is that pulse was barely covered in your schools. Right? I mean, I'm taking this for granted. So unless you went to Leon's school recently, or unless you went to one of the five element schools, pulse was barely covered. And in the five element schools, pulses are covered to this extent. You have to take thousands of them and check in with your emotions to see how you feel and create your own pulse system that's meaningful to you. But you'll never be able to communicate anything about it in your native tongue to another human being or to your patient. It's not a completely invalid approach, and of course the development of that kind of intuition is very important. And what I find with students from that tradition is that when they do finally start seriously studying pulse, they have an enormous database of impressions to draw from because they've spent a lot of time doing it. Nonetheless, the Chinese culture spent 4,000 years developing pulse diagnosis. No one has trivialized pulse diagnosis more than the Chinese culture in the last 100 years. So we have a lot that we have to hold when we're looking at it. So it's interesting that so many people came out. This says that there's a great interest in understanding pulse. But it doesn't really seem to be the priority of the schools. They seem more interested in giving biochemistry, physics, and microbiology courses these days, for the most part, than in actually teaching Chinese medicine. So for those of us who actually love Chinese medicine on the one hand, on its own merits, and on the other hand, who realize that we exist in a cultural condition, a human condition today on the planet that has never existed before in the history, in the last 4,000 years, right? The Chinese who created Chinese medicine, writing 1,000 BC and then writing the text 500 to 300 BC and up through the present, they're not the same human beings as are sitting in this room today. Their cultural conditions, their assumptions about the universe and the world they live in were completely different than ours. Most of us couldn't relate to any of those assumptions, not to most of them. If you read many of the historic books, the leading authors on Chinese medicine, the leading author on pulse, Li Zhishan, was very clear that women give birth to foxes and have sex with ghosts, and that foxes give birth to human children. And if you're not open-minded enough to understand this, you shouldn't even be reading his books, because you'll never become a master of the medicine. And I don't think anyone in here can really relate to that in any literal way. But he believed it as absolute truth. He was very clear on that. We live in a very different cultural context. We live in a world-centric everyone in this room would consider themselves a world-centric citizen. So we're interested in learning from the past, learning the traditions. There's a lot of beauty in the depth of Chinese medicine. But I think most of us have a sense that we're facing a condition on the planet today that needs a new solution, that needs a quality of consciousness, a new way of looking at the human condition from a human who's never existed before, diagnosing and treating a kind of human being who's never existed before. So this is the challenge of pulse diagnosis. On the one hand, there's a tremendous depth that can be learned in terms of traditions and in terms of history. And on the other hand, we really do have to forge something new, something that makes sense in the context of the people we see today. Anybody who's been practicing for more than a couple years in the northeastern part of the United States has to realize that their TCM tradition was insufficient. You have to realize that people are coming in with syndrome patterns that aren't in the books. Right? They're just not in the books. Now, it probably is true that nobody in Chinese history suffered from liver yang deficiency. If you've ever met the Chinese, and you don't meet many Chinese with liver yang deficiency, even today. But don't we see a lot of liver yang deficiency? There aren't any syndrome patterns based on it. But if you have patients with chronic fatigue, or people who've smoked pot every day for 20, 30 years, and you press their liver pulse and it just collapses, there's nothing there. There's no syndrome pattern in any of the books talking about one of the main conditions that we treat. So I think we live at a very interesting time for the development of Chinese medicine. Now, people take different... people have different contributions to make to the medicine. So there are some people who I respect very deeply who are interested in the classics and interpreting the classics. And I think it's important to have respect for lineage to an extent. And so I think in the right hands, the insights that come from the ancients can be valuable contributions. But you always have to keep in mind that the people who wrote the Tao Te Ching and the Nei Ching and the Ling Shu and the classic texts never met the kind of human being sitting in this room. They never met a human being with a world-centric value system who had they never met a human being probably with disposable income and leisure time. Do you realize that everyone sitting in this room has more options and more freedom than the Emperor of China had when the Nei Ching was written? Do you think the Emperor of China could have said, where do you want to go to dinner tonight? Should we have Northern Italian or Southern Italian? Which of the 7 sushi bars? Do we want Northern Indian or Southern Indian? Or maybe we should go to that new Swedish restaurant. I hear, you know, they have great meatballs. The Emperor of China couldn't have said that. Which movie do you want to see? Which of the 900 channels do you want to watch? So it turns out when the survival needs are met of human beings, when survival needs are met, the medical imperative switches from the priority of having to treat external syndrome patterns to treating internal syndrome patterns. Because when survival needs are met and a person's primary concern has nothing to do with, will I have enough food to feed my family tonight? Where will we sleep tonight? Will the Mongols come and kill all of us tonight? And 85% of the world still lives like that. But in the population here in the Northeast that we treat, and I don't know all of you, but I'm going to guess to include everybody in this room, survival needs are met. And what happens when survival needs are met? And the threat to oneself is no longer external and out of one's hands?
Get lazy.
Well, people get lazy and crazy. Right? Which means the greatest threat to one's well-being comes from one's own mind. It means all of the primary cause of illness shifts to the internal syndrome patterns. To the internal syndrome patterns. No physician or philosopher or scholar who wrote any of the classic texts ever met a human being like that, who was living in that cultural condition. Maybe the royal family, and even they didn't have anywhere near the kind of political, social, religious freedom. Do you think that the royal family in China would have considered themselves world-centric 500 BC? World-centric? Lao Tzu wrote that you should grow up in your town and hear the dogs barking. in the next village, and the rooster's crowing and never meet the people who own them. And here Lee sits with an Apple laptop hooked into the wireless network of the hotel, and she has at her fingertips the sum total of the world's knowledge. She could Skype someone in Brazil now, and somebody in Russia, and someone in mainland China, and they could teleconference. Hardly the same as, well, I hear the dogs barking. How far can you hear a dog bark in a valley? Half a mile? So the people live, what, 4,000 feet away, and you're never going to meet them? It's hardly world-centric, right? So we're a new kind of human being, and we're going to have to become a kind of human being that's never existed before if the human race is going to survive. This is the context of our clinical practice. So unless you're doing most of your treatment with drug addicts or the homeless, which is fine, it's a different population though. Unless you're working in inner city, doing most of your work in inner city with people. You know, up here in Vermont, you're, and in Massachusetts, in New England in general, we're dealing with everyone. Would anyone here have to explain to one of their patients why recycling's important? Well, a couple of your patients, but for the most part, people would get it up here, wouldn't they? That means they're world-centric. They're holistic and they're integral thinkers, even if they don't know it. But it means they understand implicitly as a value that actions they take have an impact on the whole biosphere. Right? Now, for the Chinese, the whole biosphere meant the river I'm sitting next to. They didn't know there were other countries and other people when the historic text. They thought there was one culture on the planet. Right? So they hardly had a world-centric point of view. They didn't understand linear thinking very well. But at an integral level of development, I'm guessing most people in this room can think causally and reductionistically, mechanistically, materialistically, holistically, synthetically, all at the same time and don't see any contradiction. Do you understand? Okay, but that's very advanced. When I was in graduate school doing my working on toward my doctorate in neurobiology in 1981, I was literally at the same time working on a graduate thesis on using brain implantation of brain fetal tissue into people with Alzheimer's and Parkinson's to see if we could get brains to regenerate. So I'm writing a thesis on, a proposal on this, and at the same time preparing a presentation on the innervation of the shoe points for the second National Acupuncture Conference down in Washington, D.C. And I'm literally, I've got all the information on both sides of my desk, and I'm feeling completely schizophrenic. Because when I'm writing one, I don't understand any Chinese medicine. And when I'm working on the five-element innervation of the shoe points, I'm like, everything on this side of the desk is BS. And it was just back and forth. And whenever I was focused on one, the whole other universe of it disappeared. And I could remember sitting there feeling the brain cells growing across my corpus callosum. Like I was in agony. It's like if you play piano trying to do polyrhythms with different hands. I don't know if that's a meaningful metaphor, but, you know, 4-4 and 3-4. It drives you crazy. And then eventually you can do it. But today, everyone in this room, I think, takes a form of consciousness for granted that in 1980 caused me migraine. And just saying, I mean, it's a very interesting evolution and development. The Chinese did not have that form of consciousness. They had holistic synthetic consciousness. But that's all they had. They didn't have East and West brought together as one and then synthesizing something even greater out of it that's bigger than the sum of its parts. So we're a new human being with a new evolutionary challenge. Doesn't everyone in here get the sense we're at a critical point in history? See, in 1970, you could think, okay, we'll get the environment together. Yeah, we're polluting, but we're going to take care of everything. My 13th birthday was on the first Earth Day. So I was born April 21st. April 22nd, 1970 was the first Earth Day. Went to see the play Hair with the original Broadway cast in New York. And you walked around and there were 100,000 people in the streets with big pictures of the Earth, right, as seen from space. Well, when that first picture came back and everyone saw us just as a little ball floating in space, a development in consciousness occurred. You understand? That could not have happened prior to that. That did not happen prior to that. The Chinese talked in terms of emptiness. They talked in terms of transcending the world, right? Transcending the world. But not, they didn't know diddly about cosmological development or 15 billion year context and developmental stream. So we know a lot today. So this is all back, this is what informs my practice and my inquiry and the work that I'm doing. What Lee referred to as very interesting random conversations are the most significant conversations that can be had. If you're going to practice medicine, don't you think minimally you should know who you are, why you're here, and how to live in accordance with it? So before anyone could apply any medical theory, one would have to know who they were in a context that made sense in the 21st century, right? Why they were on the planet, and from that would come, okay, recognizing who I am and why I'm here, how do I live in accordance with that? And if a person knows these three things, then one is in a position to bring that context to oneself and to other human beings. And in a very real and a very, very literal sense, you know patience by knowing yourself. And in no other way. So we have a cultural illusion having come through the pluralism and postmodernism of the 1960s. We have a cultural illusion that every patient is unique and different, and every human being is unique and different. I bet that's a hallmark, bottom line, invisible assumption that everyone in here adheres to. Right? You have to differentiate every patient, and every patient is completely unique. That's true at only the most insignificant and mundane levels, which would be at the level of their physical body in terms of unique combinations of syndrome patterns. And even that, I mean, there are only so many, right? But it turns out that there are fundamental mechanisms at work in every human being. And what I've discovered after 24 years, and you can look into this for yourself, but what I've discovered after about 55,000 clinical sessions with patients is there is only one patient. So there's the life impulse, there's the death impulse, and between the life and the death impulse, there's a human being making choices. And those choices are, to more of a less of a degree, conscious or unconscious. And the path of healing is to make the unconscious conscious, to bring clarity to things. Chinese medicine is a very, very wonderful medicine for that. So when I see a patient, I want to be able to understand that beneath all the conditioning, we're all identically the same. So when you remove generational conditioning, meaning Gen X, Gen Y, baby boomer, Second World War, that would be about what's alive today. When you remove generational conditioning, nationalistic conditioning, religious conditioning, familial conditioning, gender conditioning, when you remove all the conditioning beneath all that, there's only one human being. There's one consciousness in the universe. And so, to me, medicine, in its deepest and highest sense, which doesn't at all diminish the importance of being able to understand symptomatology and help treat illness, but in the deepest and highest sense of the medicine, from a spiritual perspective, in terms of recognition and fulfillment of destiny, we start at this position of recognizing oneness, not just as an intellectual property, but as a fact. Not just as an intellectual idea, but as an actual fact. So we know there's oneness, and then we know there's a lot built on top of that, that just isn't true, that just isn't real. which any authentic spirituality will reveal to be false. And from my point of view, in the deepest and highest sense, Chinese medicine is a very powerful method for eliminating the stagnation of conditioning and revealing that pure one consciousness that exists underneath to bring more and more and more and more clarity. And of course, the ultimate goal is to liberate that influence in a person so that it takes on a life of its own within them that can't be ignored. And what this means is it's important to awaken people's conscience and to help people have a real and living relationship to their own soul, and to have people understand, on the one hand, the momentum in them that is completely morbidly infatuated with the death impulse, and on the other hand, to understand the absolute nature of choice they have to give to the life impulse. So what I've discovered in my clinical practice is that there's a part of the self that loves healing, but has no intention of ever being healed. Not in this lifetime, not in the next lifetime. It'll do massage and Tai Chi and acupuncture and Qigong. It'll take herbs. It'll go hear gurus. It'll go to Machu Picchu. It'll take ayahuasca in the rainforest. It'll do tantric sex. It'll do the whole thing, and it loves all of it under the auspices of healing. And it never has the slightest bit of intention at all, ever, not in this lifetime, not in any incarnation, of ever being healed. And its sole motivation is to use the rest of its existence to overcome everything it's already experienced up to this point. So the rest of this life, the rest of the next life, the next 10,000 incarnations are all to get over what it's already experienced. And then the other aspect of the self, which is unknown to most people, nothing ever happened there, nothing ever could happen there, nothing is happening there, it's absolutely fine, it can't relate to the idea of healing, because it's never been wounded, traumatized, or victimized. And its only interest is in creating a more wholesome future right now. See, its only interest is right here, right now. Let's make things better. Right? So, one self says, I'd love to do that. It sounds great, but you don't understand. Another person could do this, but I've been through so much. And every human being I've ever treated, if you look into it deeply, their thesis is, whatever happened in my life would have affected other people less, but it hit me as hard as it did because I'm so sensitive. You see, other people would have done much better with this stuff, but it hit me as strongly as it did because I'm just very sensitive, and because I'm so sensitive, I need more time to heal. And this other part of the self, which involves this, what we call Shen and Jing and the soul, right? It says, what? What, are you nuts? You're alive right now. And you're a vehicle for the expression of something which has been going for 15 billion years, and the only reason you're in that body is to make things better. Not just for yourself, but for everything and everyone else. To every day, with every breath, make everything around you better. And that's the only reason you're here, and you're not here for anything else. And this self goes, but. That sounds right, and I recognize that. Of course that's true, but, you know, I'd love to talk about this, but I'm late for my massage. I gotta go punch a punching bag and scream for a while. I'll be back and then we can continue the conversation. So, these are the forces at work, and between these forces, there's you making a choice. what do I give my attention? Where do I put my attention? From a five-element point of view, the five-element constitutional types tell you where, as a matter of fate, a person has been conditioned from the moment of conception to put their attention. So a person who's water constitutionally is going to interpret something that happens with a blue lens, and a person who's wood will interpret it with a green lens, and a person who's red with a red lens, the same thing happening, and they'll just draw conclusions according to the conditioned value systems of those elements. And the eight principle system tells us, given the conclusions a person's drawn based on their life experience, how are they likely to and how have they embodied their quality of consciousness in the vehicle? How has the choices that a person has made throughout their life, and how has the external forces, because we are still subjected to external forces, how have the external forces and the internal force of the person's mind impacted physiology? And everybody's on that five-element wheel. That's called samsara, the five-element wheel. So water, wood, fire, earth, metal. Well, it is. The Chinese characters for it are the same as, you know, the Sheng cycle, birth cycle. Well, samsara is Shengsi, birth, death. Just the wheel, birth, death, birth, death. Okay, that whole five-element cycle is a cycle of conditioned weather, thought, and feeling. And the point is that one wants to arrive at the center of that circle so that emotions always change, and thoughts always change, and weather always changes, and we want to be cultivating a position that's always free of all of that, that sees through all of that, that isn't caught up in any of it, that isn't personalizing the experience to create a self, but all these thoughts and all these feelings and all this weather. When qi moves externally, weather changes and seasons change. When qi moves internally, we have emotions and we have thoughts. And the weather and the thoughts and the feelings have nothing to do with us. But you wouldn't know it to talk to most of us, right? My thoughts and my feelings create the universe. You have your truth and I have my truth. I know this sounds crazy, but I just have to go with my feelings. You see? I just have to check in. See, that kind of stuff. So the Taoists knew this. I mean, the Taoist canon was clear that the five-element cycle was a cycle of conditioned ignorance, and the whole point was to be at the center of the circle. But it's not really what's taught, and it's not how postmodern people view just about anything, right? We all think that our thoughts and feelings create our universe. My universe. The universe is a projection of my mind. Whenever anyone tells me that, I want to hit him in the head with my shoe and say, that was a strange thing for you to do. How do you think that would go over? So, this is background. This is the context that has to inform all of Chinese medicine, at least probably in the United States today, at least in the Northeast, Boulder, Santa Fe, and the West Coast, right? If you're practicing in Alabama, there'd be, well, you're going to have to lead a revolution down there, right? Right? You're in Alabama? Wow. Is acupuncture legal there? Well, it doesn't have to be very far removed from voodoo. So anyway, well, you know, what I'm talking about in general, I mean, it would be hard to find world-centric people on average in Alabama. Right? On average. That doesn't mean there aren't there.
But they show up for acupuncture.
Yeah, but I just mean on average. So there are cultural differences. So a patient comes in, you have to know all this. This is by way of background. When Lee originally asked me what I wanted to teach, I said, Chinese medicine and the evolution of consciousness. She said, that won't sell up here in Vermont. Even though I'm giving her a little heat. But it's a very interesting thing. See, you live up here in Vermont, you can maintain the illusion that consciousness doesn't evolve. Do you see? Because it's still about 1972. right? And you can maintain the illusion that the world isn't going to hell. You look out the window in a few weeks, all the leaves will be on the trees, and the deer, Bambi will be out there playing by the flowers. And but you can maintain the illusion, right? You live out on your mountaintop, you go, this is great. See? But it's a little hotter further south to maintain the illusion, but not impossible, because frankly most people where I live still think everything's about the same and we just have to get the economy going again and then we'll have taken care of all our problems. Just have to figure out how to make 20% a year and things will be good. So I wrote back and said, oh, that's interesting. Doesn't want the evolution of consciousness. Okay, how about pulse diagnosis? And she said, yeah, that's good. So I had to give the intro because, one, I want you to know who I am. And if I'm teaching pulse diagnosis, you have to understand the context it's occurring in. So why would we want to learn pulse diagnosis? Why would it still be important? I mean, every day I get these things for the new pulse machine. And the new thing you can plug your fingertips into, or the little metal pen that'll give you a digital readout and explain to your patient what you're doing and why you're doing it, and it takes 3 minutes per patient. I had a demonstration of one of these at a TCM conference I was teaching at a few years ago. These Russian women pulled me over, and they asked me to sit down, and I said, sure, hook me up. So the woman hooked me up to her laptop computer and all the lights are blinking and the graphs are going like this and I'm sitting there, you know, thinking, okay, I mean, I'm open-minded, show me what it says. And the woman says to me, I can't really do a Russian accent, so it comes out sounding German, but she says, you know, this is the most impressive technology Russian has to offer. And just as she says that, her friend trips over the wire and the whole laptop goes flying off onto the floor. It breaks, and all the wires go off me. As she's in the middle, this is the most impressive technology. And it goes, boom! Anyway, so why would we want to learn pulse diagnosis? After all, the Nanjing, you know, says, I forget which difficult issue it is. It's between 50 and 60. It says that, you know, those who look and the highest form of diagnosis is to just look and know, and compares people who can do that to being like, spirits. And then it says, you know, then there's to ask and know, and then and it goes down to a hierarchy, and then it says those who diagnose based on pulse are like skilled workmen. Right? So it's still, I mean, it's still mentioning it, but it's not putting it very high up there. And it is true that after a while you can know an awful lot just by talking to someone for 5 seconds when you've been in clinical practice for a while. So why do pulse? We do pulse because it really preserves and develops our humanity. And because it integrates physical touch and grounds all the other observations we're having. So while it's true that one can know an awful lot about a human being in a few seconds, how do you know you're right? You can't know you're right. You can't ever know. So in a holographic model, you want to bring as many avenues of inquiry and as many avenues of collecting data in to form, you know, this web that Ted Kapchuk alludes to, and web that has no weaver. You don't just want one node or two nodes of that web. The more data points converging you can get, you know, it would be like having a pointillist painting with one dot or just the red dots. But the more color dots come in and the farther back you stand, the more of a perspective you have to have a coherent picture come out. You know, the ego has intuition. You can't assume that just because something is intuition, it's either correct or wholesome. The ego has intuition. The ego knows. Intuition just means recognition pre-thought. Intuition is just the recognition of something prior to mind. You understand? Prior to thinking. Prior to analysis. The spontaneous recognition. But the ego spontaneously recognizes how to get what it wants. And it always has a selfish motive. So the ego knows how to manipulate and connive pre-thought, completely intuitively. So there's a higher intuition and a lower intuition, and the lower intuition is just how to manipulate, coerce, and seduce others. to one's own ends. And the higher intuition is to see what is actually the greater reality for the benefit of all, for the good of all, for the sake of the whole. So putting our fingers on people to take pulses deeply integrates humanity. Machines are good for an awful lot, and I love my iPod Touch, and I love my Apple laptop, and I really couldn't be as productive in the world without them. They begin to form an extension of your nervous system, right? And they free up a lot because you don't have to remember it. Help you integrate a lot. It's all good. None of it's a problem. Technology doesn't make us less human. What makes us less human is not putting attention on our humanity. So, pulse diagnosis is a way to put attention on humanity. Now, in terms of the tradition, the five-element tradition, we're diagnosing based on color, the sound in a person's voice, their odor, and their emotion. These are the fastest changing waveforms that can be perceived at a distance. So a person can be talking and the sound in their voice can be going back and forth between two and three elements. Their odor can be changing. Their emotion can be changing. Color can be changing continually, fluctuating in real time. The pulse is the fastest changing waveform in a person. Now a person's tongue changes, but it doesn't change every millisecond. I mean, if you looked at a person's tongue and the coat was changing color every 3 seconds, you'd probably want to run out of the room. And, you know, the hara can change a bit as you're doing diagnosis or before and after treatment. But it's not changing. You know, I think you get the idea. The pulse is this instantaneous waveform with a subtlety on it that goes far beyond the mind's capacity to capture. So, in a typical diagnostic, I spend an hour and a half with every new patient diagnosing them. And the first 30 to 45 minutes of that, maybe an hour if the person is a blabbermouth or really has an extraordinary medical history, would be spent collecting data. So, you know, you go through an intake. I mean, we all learned about the same kind of intake. In Nourishing Destiny, I published the exact intake that I do. But my experience is the intake itself isn't that different from the intake anyone would do. I don't use any forms. I have people fill out nothing, right? So I'm collecting all the data from the person. And I'm interested not just in the data, but in how the person is relating to the data while they're giving it to me. So I'm spending half an hour to an hour on this. And then I take every new patient's pulse minimally for half an hour. Okay? And usually, 30 to 40 minutes. It just depends. 30 to 40 minutes on every new patient who comes in. And I fill out this entire chart on everyone who comes in. And you've gotten one of these. You don't have to look at it now. I've only given this to you just so you can see get an idea. There's no way we could possibly cover this weekend. It would take me 2 hours to lecture on any one of these positions on here. So just to say a little bit by way of history and in terms of context, I learned pulse diagnosis from a student of J.R. Worsley's in 1980. So I've been doing pulse diagnosis. I was fascinated with it. So from the moment I learned it, I took everybody's pulses who would sit and let me take their pulses. So I've been doing pulse diagnosis for 29 years. And, in Chinese, they say, in Chinese culture, it takes 20 years to master pulse. No, it takes 20 years to get any kind of inkling that you're never going to master pulse. So now I've been going at it 29 years, so I have 9 years into knowing that I'm never really going to get this. It just becomes more and more and more and more of a mystery. But anything that would be worth doing would be at least that deep. I've been meditating very seriously now. Well, I don't know how seriously, but I meditate an hour a day, except when I'm interrupted for breakfast. And 4 hours on the Sundays I don't teach. And I've been doing it 7 years, and after 7 years, I mean, it's just I learn something new all the time about it. You see? Because the only part of you that can learn about meditation is the part you're supposed to be letting go of in meditation. You see? So it's quite a mysterious thing. So I started in the five-element tradition, and I would guess the pulse system I learned, even though we might have learned a few different things about it, I'd guess it's the same thing that everybody knows in here, which would be the Nanjing system, where you have, on the left side, you have heart, liver, and kidney. We have small intestine, gallbladder, and bladder above them. And on the right side, you would have distally lungs and colon, stomach, spleen. And then you've learned either heart protector, three heater, or kidney yang. Did anyone learn a different pulse system than that? It's a usual thing they talk about in schools. I learned that pulse system, and I did that for years. And when I was in acupuncture school in 1984 to 86, I went through the Traditional Acupuncture Institute in Maryland. I met Leon Hammer there twice while I was in school. And when I graduated from school in 86, I moved to Western Massachusetts and discovered that Leon Hammer was about a little over an hour away in Saratoga in his clinical practice. So I called and asked if he would teach me. And he was only in clinical practice for a couple years after that before he retired, because at that time he would have been in his 60s. And I would go up and I would spend the day following Leon around his clinic and take classes with him. And after just the first class I took with him, or the second, I took on organizing all his classes for 10 years. So all the classes he taught on the East Coast, or at least most of them, were in my office in Stockbridge. So I studied with him 86 to 95, maybe early 96. And so most of what I'm going to be teaching you from this weekend is actually that lineage, as opposed to the five-element tradition pulses. So one has to be... Chinese medicine, again, is a science of holding dualities. One has to be able to hold that, you know, this pulse system is good for these things and works when a patient's lying down and with this much pressure. And this pulse system is good for these things and works when the patient's sitting up and the locations are different and this much pressure. You've got to be able to handle all these different things, right? Like, you know, Kiko says this point's good for this, but so-and-so says it's good for that, and so-and-so says it's good for that. And you don't say, well, no, Kiko's right and this person's wrong. You just keep adding it all in, and seeing what works in your own clinical experience. And what doesn't work, you let go of. Does anyone in here keep doing points they learned for indications that never worked for them? Just because they were taught this is... No, I mean, as soon as you do it three times and it doesn't work, or someday you do some other point combination, you get an amazing result, and you go, wow. And then you try it on the next 50 people, and it works on three, and you say, okay, this will work on this kind of person. With this, and right. So, anyway, some of the things I might be teaching in here might conflict with some things you've already learned, but you don't make it a conflict, you hold, okay, well, in certain scenarios this is right, but I'll keep an open mind and I'll consider and I'll try this. See if this is right. This Worsley five-element system, this Nanjing system, is very good when it comes to meridian energetics. So when it comes to things like entry-exit blocks and relative excess and deficiency on the pulse, it works fine. But it's completely useless for herbal prescription, for the most part. And it doesn't make any intuitive sense, does it, that the small intestine and the colon would be in the upper heater, or the heart protector would be in the lower heater? Doesn't really make much sense. So if you look at the first page I've given you, and you just quickly do a visual scan, you'll see that every pulse position here exactly corresponds to the location of the organ in the body. The triple warmer is done, and we're going to cover this, the triple warmer is done by take both distal positions for the upper chow, take both middle positions for the middle chow, take both lower positions for the lower chow. But it's not a discrete single place.
Yeah, some people throw it in.
It's the whole thing. Well, you could say it's kidney yang, which would be the right proximal position. But we don't think about it exactly analogously. What I'm presenting is my take on what's called now the Shen, meaning Dr. Shen, Dr. John Shen. He lived to about 93 years old. He died about 5 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago. He and Worsley and Van Buren from Holland all died within about a month of each other. So, I mean, that whole generation disappeared in a few weeks. And Leon's probably going to live to be 110, which is a good thing. He's written a new book on the practitioner-client relationship. And I haven't seen it yet, but I would recommend everybody get a copy because I have complete faith in his work. And there are very few people with Leon's depth of insight into the human condition, and just the humanity he writes with is very beautiful and should really fill out this trilogy of books he's written. Dragon Rises, the Pulse book that he wrote, which is just clinical and totally dry, and this book should bring all the humanity to it. It should be very interesting. I haven't had a chance to read it yet because I'm holding out for a signed copy. I keep emailing him saying, Leon, send me a signed copy. I'm sure he's busy. So this is what we're going to cover this weekend, because I can only give you a broad overview of the pulse in a weekend. Does that make sense? Like, I used to teach the whole thing in one weekend, and it was completely insane to do that. So what we're going to get through this weekend is we're going to look at qualities on the whole pulse. That means taking the pulse both sides with three fingers on each hand. So the whole pulse, the left side and the right side, the three depths of the pulse, qi, blood, organ, and the three chow. Okay, distal, middle, lower, right? Upper, middle chow, lower chow. Okay? Going to try to cover that today. We're going to look at stability on the pulse, rate, rhythm, intensity, amplitude, and stability of qualities. We're going to talk about how to treat what we find, some broad-based treatments for those findings. And with any luck, tomorrow we're going to cover understanding the continuum of yin and yang deficiency on the pulse. So if anyone lives long enough, they're going to become jing deficient, right? But they're... Well, right? I mean, if you live long enough...
Earlier.
Well, but you still have to live that long, right? So you still... It is true people are becoming jing deficient. People are becoming jing deficient earlier now than when I started clinical practice. When I first started treating with Leon... I mean, studying with him, I just didn't see anyone in their 40s with Jing deficiency. I can't ever remember, and now you do see people all the time with Jing deficiency in their 40s. In part, this has to do with environmental toxicity. In part, it has to do with multitasking. If you live long enough, you're going to become Jing deficient, but there are two, all Jing deficiency is not equal. There are two paths to becoming Jing deficient. You can become Jing deficient through a path of Yin deficiency or through a path of Yang deficiency. And I'm going to cover all the qualities and their implications in the life of the person who becomes Jing deficient through a path of Yin deficiency and a path of Yang deficiency, and talk about the stages of life, the patient's age versus what you're finding on the whole pulse or in an individual position. If there's time, and I don't know if there will be, I'm going to elaborate the relationship between work, physical work, emotional work, and drawing on yin and yang in a way that creates all these pulses, and the excessive use of the egoic use of will to create either through the nervous system or through the body. In other words, driving oneself to do too much physical work, or driving oneself to do too much emotional, psychological, or intellectual work. I should have given that before I wrote my two books, but then we wouldn't be here today. I should have had the lecture, and I did have the lecture. I knew everything there. I wrote them anyway. And there may be a couple other things that we cover, but I don't know if we'll have time. Okay? Anyone have any questions about anything? No? Okay. Yes. It's good for meridian level things. So in other words, that system of diagnosis is a forced fit to the five element theory. Isn't it clear the small intestine isn't above the diaphragm or the colon? That system is all about the five element theory and the Chinese clock. So for anything relative to the Chinese clock, in terms of circulation of qi in the big circle, which is the five element circle, anything relevant to that cycling of energy, that pulse system is very good. Look, the simple fact is, those of you who went through TCM schools, probably many of you went through clinics that had teachers from China in the clinics. How many pulse qualities did they identify over the year or two of seeing patients with them?
In class or in the clinic?
Either way.
There were 27, but in clinic there were probably five.
Right, five in clinic, right? Everything was spinning bean, bowstring, or slippery.
Was the cheap blood fluids basically wiring.
Okay, but five qualities more or less. So they say 27 or they say 32, but I've never met a Chinese practitioner other than Zhang Shen who was doing practically more than five qualities, and they couldn't recognize more than five. The rest of it was just reading out of a book. They had just been taught it and they were lecturing because they had a lecture about it, but they couldn't recognize. That's not true across the board. I'm just saying it's the general experience of that I have with students who've been in clinics with China, because every student who comes to me from my class knows five qualities, because that's what the people were seeing in clinic. The pulse system that I'm doing here has 60 different qualities, 50 places to put your finger, and ultimately 9 depths to the pulse. So we're not going to talk about all of that. You don't have to worry about all of that right now. But we have to understand that reality is analog, not digital, right? Which means that how many pulse qualities are there really? 700 trillion? And our categories reflect more the limits of the human nervous system and the limit of discernment of human consciousness at a particular moment, then it really says anything about the pulse. In terms of limits, in terms of placing limitations on the pulse. Doesn't it make sense that if 60 qualities have been identified, there might be 61? 62? Right? People are evolving. Times are changing. New syndrome patterns are occurring. But none of that's a problem. That's how it should be in any system that's developmental, that's evolutionary. You would expect it to grow over time. So it's important to do pulse to get us in touch with humanity, to ground our observations in the body of the person. When I first started treating people, this was my experience. I was fresh out of school and my first patient came in. He had been diagnosed by his physicians with polyneuropathy attendant to diabetes, had been out of work for quite a while, and had been in agony for 7 years. Like if you brushed his skin anywhere, he would feel like you were ripping him with a knife. And he was my second patient treating, and actually the first in my clinic when I opened my office. After graduating, and he came in and I shook his hand and I did an intake and I drained aggressive energy. And he came back 3 days later for his next treatment. He said, "Oh, my pain's gone, I'm back at work." And I was like, wow. That's amazing. And people were having these mind-blowing experiences, even though I'm sure I barely knew what I was doing. I mean, I remember this, one of these first women came in and she's lying on her back, and I'd been taught to do abdominal diagnosis, which I could have cared less about, which is not to diminish it. I'm just saying I could have cared less about it. Not because I shouldn't have really cared about it, but just because I'm completely arrogant and you can only learn so much, and it just didn't seem to interest me, so I didn't pay much attention. So, but we were taught, press on the mu points and notice they're tender and what you feel. Say, okay, so I'm looking around trying to find CV14. That's all I'm doing, is trying to find it. And I'm going like this, and she says, I just want to stop right here and acknowledge how deeply you're working. I'm thinking to myself, well, wait till I get going, because... But you see, we're all very sensitive, and we're all conditioned to have experiences, right? We're all just conditioned to have experiences, consume, and we're big, fat consumers of experience. So, my experience was people were getting better very quickly, and they were coming into me, and this is just in the first 3 to 4 months of clinical practice. People were coming in day after day and saying, I don't know what you're doing, but I feel better than I have in years. But the thing, and that was good for a while, but after a little while I started recognizing, well, they're feeling great, but something's terribly wrong and I don't know what it is. I would look at their tongue, I would take their pulse, I would just sit with them and say, they're reporting this incredibly powerful psycho-emotional experience, endorphined out bliss, which we're almost all conditioned to have, and they're coming in happy and they're filled with energy and everything's positive. But I look at their tongue and I take their pulse and I don't even have the words for it, but they're on a railroad track and there's a train coming. Do you see? And it made me feel very uneasy in myself. And at that point I said, there was this doctor who came and he seemed to know a lot. And I found out who Leon was. I called Bob Duggan and said, who was that guy who was coming into class? Who was he? And he said, Leon Hammer, he lives up near you. Oh, that's cool. And he was a physician, and I called and started studying with Leon. Now, my response to studying with Leon is across the board what I find the responses from people who study with me, which is, at some point you feel as though you're sorry you asked. So what most, my own experience in life is that, you know, which is something my teacher Andrew has said, and it's exactly my experience, is you pray all your life for God to show up, and then God shows up, you find out he's a greedy bastard. Right? And wants everything. And that the demand is absolute, and you sit there overwhelmed, completely overwhelmed in what you've discovered. And part of you, the ego, sitting there saying, oh my God, why did I put one foot on the path? You see? So, there is something very nice about not knowing and being naive, because you can treat people and hold their hands and massage them and make them feel better. But who are we making feel better? We're making feel better the top 2% of all fortunate beings who've ever lived in the history of the human race. We're making them feel better. I'm under so much stress, my retirement fund is down by half. I'm under so much, you don't know what it's like driving my kids to soccer 3 days a week. I don't get enough sex. You see, the people have real problems we deal with. Something happened to me 27 years ago, which I have no interest in really getting over, but I'd like to pay you to talk about it at this point in my life, and then I'll move on and pay the 78th person to talk about it after you. You see? So the thing is that when one starts really getting interested in doing something really meaningful, which means getting in touch with those forces that are already fine, okay, and don't need to heal, and liberating that in a person, and doing something really to treat the body, really to really find out what's going on, it's overwhelming. Because what you discover, which is beautiful because it creates humility, right? And I'm not very good at humility, but to any degree I have it, it has in part been contributed to by recognizing that one arrives at a state where one can diagnose far beyond what one will ever be able to treat effectively. You see? So if you're in Chinese medicine for a while, you'll get to a point where you can see a patient and lecture for 3 hours. I mean, I can do a pulse diagnosis on someone for 30 minutes, and I can sit here and lecture for 3 hours on that person. And you can do a lot with people, but look, you could take somebody with Lou Gehrig's syndrome and you could do a perfect TCM diagnosis on them, but it don't mean they won't be dead in 3 months. Right? So you can explain everything, and you could say, this is what should be done, and these are the herbs, and this is the acupuncture. But, you know, if a person has ovarian cancer or esophageal, there's just an awful lot we can diagnose. And it creates a sense of humility. But the thing that's beautiful, on the one hand, you know, you get to say, look, I'm doing everything I can do. So you don't have to feel like, well, I'm just fooling around selling people experiences. I really am doing everything that I can do. So then your conscience is clear. And what is true is that in general, you can have confidence that you're helping people at a much, much, much deeper level than you were prior when you were just selling them positive experiences. And it also gives you the confidence to stay with a treatment plan a long time, which is something you can only have after years of clinical practice. I can remember early on, I'd diagnose something, give somebody the herbs, and after a week or two, if they weren't working, I'd go try another formula. And now, or another acupuncture approach. And now I'm very happy to stay with something 6 months to a year. I just keep telling people, I know you're not getting better, just keep coming. Because I know, look, This is going to take 6 months. You come every week. And then they come in and it might be 5 months, it might be seven, but they say, my God, I'm getting better. I say, oh. See? By the time someone's dug himself into a hole for 40, 50, 60 years, it's reasonable to spend 6 months until you see a little light at the end of the tunnel, don't you think? But most people want to push a button and have it better. Right? I bought this program on my iPod Touch to get better, and it's not working. You know, everyone wants to push a button and have a result. Push send on your email, and if it takes 4 seconds to get to China, it's not there yet? It's like, okay, it took 8 seconds. It has to go to space and come back. It's not a small thing. What do you mean? It's been 3 minutes. You didn't get my email. Something's wrong. You see, so this is the world we live in. It's what we're part of the context and part of the spiritual illness that we have is that wanting immediate gratification and everything.